Welcome back, everyone, to Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm your host, Doug Kameen, and today I'm talking with Carlos Soriano, the Director of IT for Applications and Business Intelligence at RectorSeal. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Douglas.
Yeah. So it's great to have you on the show and get a chance to talk to you about your leadership journey. But before we got on the recorded part of our discussion, you're telling me you got a big week coming up here. A lot of stuff going on.
We have a couple of big initiatives coming live this week. So we have today on Monday a change in the way we ingest our EDI signals for orders that will let us process and massage data much better than we currently do. So it's been a big initiative testing almost 60 different business partners that we work with, Amazon, Home Depot, all these big guys. And on Friday, we have a change in the way we interface with C.H. Robinson, which is our fleet management tool. Also, a lot of testing. We started with this almost December last year, so big projects this week. Hopefully, by the end of the week, we can still receive orders and ship stuff to places. So.
so you're affecting both ends of your supply chain on this week, right? You know, you get them coming and you get them going here.
We haven't been able to, we have to get this done since we have so many other projects coming up. So we just cannot, we have to go live same week with both. So
that's the story of IT. Like sometimes it's just got to get done. There was a gentleman he was on the podcast a month ago, and one of his like pieces of advice was he's like my grandfather told me the best way to go through something a tough time is to go do it at 90 miles an hour. So like if it's rough, you just go through it as fast as you can, and that's actually the fastest and shortest way through it.
We try to minimize risks, obviously, trying to do some verifications over the weekend to help us make sure we are there. But I'm confident they're going to go really well. So
that's right. Well, you're leading a great team, right? So your team, you and the team have this in hand.
No, I'm really lucky because I have a fantastic team, really experienced team members, and you know they test things really thoroughly, and they've been on the business for a while. So as I said, really really lucky to have that team. Mm-hmm. Amazing team.
Nice. So just getting into it a little bit here, just starting where you're at right now. So you're working for RectorSeal in Houston, Texas, and you've been there a little while, not too long. I think you're I would call you new. You've been there over a year, it looks like, but
yeah, 1 year.
You know, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know, I guess it's a great time to ask. You've been there a year in a place. Tell us a little. First of all, I guess tell us two things. One, can you tell us a little more about what it is you're doing there, and two, you know, tell us a little bit about some of the team that you're leading and you know the kind of team you're trying to build there.
Yeah. So I joined a year ago. I was really tempted by, after knowing all the leadership team, you know, really love them, really love my conversations with them. This is a really high growth company. We have a big appetite for M&A operations. So we are buying either new products for our portfolio or new companies kind of within the same segment more or less or industry, but that complements our portfolio somehow. Mm-hmm. But I like that growth. I mean, it's something also I have in my prior company, and I always enjoy, I think, for IT in order to do interesting stuff and be able to handle that growth of a company and how to scale things so that it works once you have grown 5-10 times the size or the number of employees or the customers, etc. So I like that. And I'm basically leading the applications team. We have our main ERP, which is GD Edwards. But we have many different interfaces with many other applications, and also lead the business intelligence team, which is basically reporting, Power BI reporting, all the data warehouse management, etc., and kind of the data transfer in all these interfaces. So I'm leading that team, and as I said, you know, a fantastic team in both teams. They are really skilled people, really senior people, like have, I would say, six and seven people above the 50 years old. So really experienced team. And what we've changed a little bit is the way we work. We've switched to agile methodology, which I was working before in EDP. And I think that really helped us be more quick on delivering and kind of have a much faster interaction with business teams as to, are we working in the right thing and the right priority of things? And is this the product you were expecting? And answer those questions more quickly and adjust as needed. And I think overall, both business teams and even my team are really liking working on this methodology and really value it.
So I'm going to jump in a little bit on, you mentioned about an agile, you know, you brought in an agile methodology to where you're at. And in my, so I'm a CIO for a nonprofit myself, and I just hired a director of PMO, you know, so a project managed office who works attached to IT. And during one of the early discussions with this individual, we were having a conversation about the difference between agile and, you know, waterfall methodologies for implementation. And I made the kind of generalized statement that I feel like agile was agile du jour for quite like the last like 10 years or so. Everybody's like, we need to get to agile. We need to get to agile. But agile doesn't always fit with every type of product implementation. And, you know, so like you get into this like buzzy thing where people are like, the buzzword is we must do agile. But realistically, you probably still need some of the other methodologies too, or you need a modified piece. She had mentioned, she calls it Wagile, waterfall.
Yeah. Agile. I do agree. For instance, like I think in when you have like a big project, like let's say a big M&A operation, there's also a lot of business decisions that need to take place, and you don't have them. So you really cannot work on a final solution on some aspects. So we do work sometimes in these projects with this waterfall methodology, but then when we have the kind of the full scope of things we need to do, then we start putting in sprints and doing more iterative interactions with the business teams to show them, demo them, where are we and how does it work, so that they realize and they can provide feedback sooner. So it's kind of a combination, yeah, for big projects too. But at the end of the day, what I have in my sprint, I can see what I'm working with every big project, any different initiative, any incident day to day. I have all the view of what my team is working on, all combined there in the sprint. And I appreciate that because I can answer questions easily to my boss as to what are we doing and all these things. So.
And that's really half the battle of being answering to your boss, right? It's like, as long as it looks, even if it's a mess behind the scenes, if it looks like it's all good, you're like, I have the answer. Hold on just a second, you know, and you could look that up. Like, you're good, generally
speaking.
No,
but not only in terms of leadership, so that because we have the transparency to everyone and every business team as to what are we working and what are the priorities that we are setting for the next sprints. So that they can tell us, hey, I'm not seeing the thing that I really need.
Yeah.
Can you put this on next sprint? This kind of interactions we have with them. But it's the transparency that we've provided the business, the different business teams, as to this is the plan. If you don't agree, please tell us what we need to adjust. And obviously, we are always open to suggestions. So.
Yeah. So just dive in a little backwards in your history here. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got, you know, some of the roles you've had in the past and the leadership that you've done in those?
Yeah, so my prior company in EDP, I was also kind of leading the applications team there for North America, which included Canada, Mexico, and US. But just to give you an idea of the growth, and I was there for 6 years or so. When I arrived, we had like 150 legal entities within our applications. When I left, we had 700 legal entities. Almost multiply by five the scope of work we had, to a point where we were doing, I would say, one of the the projects I would say I'm most proud of that time. We bought a company of distributed generation, the ones that they put like solar panels within rooftop or like Walmart, big warehouses, things like that. We bought a company in New York called C2 Omega, and then we integrated 200 legal entities with data migration, new bank interface, new billing interface within like 4 months. And it was during pandemic. Had like a team of, I would say, seven team members in Lisbon. We were obviously working with the people in New York office, some people in Houston office. I had a data migration guy in San Diego. I was working with Waldorf team, SAP team in Germany. So it was like a kind of all online pandemic project, you know, short deadlines. Things spread around, and we were able to go live, and I think that it was a huge accomplishment. So that's one of the. It was like 200 legal entities at the same time. So instead of configuring manually, we worked with SAP in Germany because I knew a product they have called LD, which you kind of clone companies, and then remap things. So it worked really well. But yeah, I did some other projects, warehousing projects, where I was traveling to the deep America, little places in Indianapolis or in Oklahoma, and kind of getting them to use scanners and control inventory levels and all these things. So I really learned a lot in my time in EDP. A great company to work with, it's to work for, but I just happened to have this opportunity. But really appreciate all the time being there, and I learn a lot too. Really good people. I still to this day I'm in contact with a lot of them. So
attention all of my IT leaders who don't know a lot about telecom. Many of you are still managing a pile of junk and you've inherited a telecom silo. I call it a telecom time bomb. Many of us are ignoring it because the enormity of tasks surrounding a phone system replacement is overwhelming, and there's a constant barrage of direct sales reps trying to get you into a new UCaaS system today. And the whole process ends up being filled with an unforeseen comedy of errors. However, for those of you tackling such a task, you must answer, number one, are you going to go Microsoft Teams or are you going to do something else? If it is Teams, then there's only three ways to do it, and the worst way is by just clicking the button and paying that expensive voice-enabling Teams button in your CSP's portal or asking them to do it for you. Okay, so you're not 100% sold on Teams yet because your company has a unique group of end users. Good for you for caring. Then you may be wondering, and you need to answer all of these questions. Which platforms and interfaces have easy to self-manage portals, GUIs, so that you can make moves, ads, and changes on the fly? Which platforms are the most upgradable and have functioning APIs? Who will truly interoperate with your systems? Who's going to give you free equipment and headsets, of course, and be the most cost-effective? Who's going to support your team the best with fast technical support in minutes, not days? And who's going to meet your compliancy requirements now and in the future with flexible user licensing? How about network preparation, ensuring quality of and properly layering voice applications? How do you confidently ensure a smooth cutover and avoid going in with your fingers crossed? How do you negotiate all the legal ramifications, FCC regulated SLAs that affect your terms and conditions? Things like elasticity clauses and out of contracts if they fail to deliver. How do you know what your end users are thinking and how to deal with explaining technical to people 1,000 times that don't know how to do a transfer? And even if you have all this down, what do you do if you have limited time to research, evaluate, and confidently plan a network communications upgrade that will surely impress your key stakeholders with return on investment, CapEx, OpEx, all of this stuff? Evaluate and where do you get started in an ocean of vendors? Which provider mix is going to best fit your company's culture versus just asking your peers who they use or shopping VoIP.com or Googling who's the best, and then you've got all kinds of people showing up in your inbox. This is why this is the classic put-off project where no one wants to take on the planning from start to finish, everything from auditing bills to surveying staff, researching providers, sifting through information, meeting with vendors, requesting proposals, ensuring all the effective transition without outages, and managing all of the negative Nancy naysayers who are surely going to complain about the new phone system. Let me and my special team of telecom nerds give you all of the rollout maps, RFP grids, and hold you by the hand for free and even pit providers against them and give you all of the data information on what the lowest pricing has ever been with benchmark level pricing. Everything from seeing how far you can throw those old phone systems to every detail you need surrounding Microsoft Teams integrations or all of the best UCaaS providers with custom and in and out of the box APIs. Also, some of you are dealing with who's the best fit contact center software providers for your unique group of end users and agents and staff. How can you leverage AI software to drastically increase agent efficiency? And let's not forget about workforce management tools to ensure proper staffing, all while avoiding annoying meetings and sales reps telling you it's the end of the month, President's Day specials. All you need to do is email telecom@popularit.net and we will give you all of the information, everything you need, and hold you by the hand for free. And if you like the information, great, do whatever you want with it. And if not, you can tell us to go pound sand.
So and what before, like going back further, like how did you get, you know, what were your first roles in kind of the IT space, and how did you come to be in IT?
So I really studied mechanical engineering. So it was not that IT related, but, you know, industry in Spain, unfortunately, is not on the levels that it was maybe on the past. So, you know, a lot of manufacturing obviously moved to Eastern Europe or China. So there's not that much industry anymore. So I think it's general that there's people that ends up or either in finance or IT and things like that. So that was kind of my step. I started in Deloitte Consulting. And EDP was really my first client, my first customer. We did rollouts in France, in Romania, and then I did the US implementation as well. So I was in Houston already back in 2009, 2010 for half a year. And then I moved to other customers, big ones with Deloitte. Like, that was really good thing about Deloitte. I got to work for really top companies in Spain. And some other client was Telefonica, which then also hired me. Was there working 3 years as a consultant with Deloitte, and then two internal hire. And then I was in a SAP event in Madrid, and I met this former client from EDP, and they were like looking for somebody to go to Houston, and it just worked out. And then, yeah, I was 1 year kind of coming back and forth until I kind of settled and got the visa approved and all these things. And then I moved here with my wife.
For the listeners here, the listeners of the podcast, just to lay out the timeline slightly for them, you're from Spain, and so you went to college in Spain, and you worked all over Europe. You worked for Deloitte, you know, so very you know, great opportunities to get exposed to all this stuff. You didn't really have Spain's kind of deindustrialized; it's mostly services businesses and that type of stuff, and you got this opportunity to come to Houston. When was that? Like, I know you said you came to Houston half a year first, but like, when did you fully kind of come to Houston?
Yeah, so it all started 2016, 2017. I was already moving here by September or so. But yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, really good opportunities with Deloitte as well. Just to kind of point out something, like, first, the international exposure that I had, like, had like projects in 12 different countries, traveled all over Europe, and then just made my career out of Deloitte customers, like, really, like, because EDP hired me, Telefonica hired me, they were my clients at Deloitte, so I really made my whole career around this. I think it also speaks but good about myself, you know, because if they hire you and they know you and they work with you and they hire you, it means something positive for me, right? Like,
yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. So I'm gonna turn this a little bit to some leadership questions about that history. So you've got this great track, you know, track record history, your career history, I guess I should say, is the way to put it. Your career history has you working all over Europe, you know, in multiple places in North America. I think the question that I have is, what do you see or notice that's different? Like, some key differences in how you have to lead and how business is conducted as you move between these different countries. Because even in Europe, like, business can, you know, kind of like the way business gets conducted in like Great Britain is different than the way they want to do it in Germany, you know? So like, is there any insights that you have about, like, some things you learned as you're in your travels around where you're like, oh man, you know, they do it crazy over here compared to like the way I see it in the United States or whatever the case may be.
No, I think, you know, it's also about the size of the companies as well, maybe. Where I work, Telefonica is huge, like, it's 120,000 employees, you know, 365 million customers all over the world. It's huge. And EDP is also really big. So I think it's a little bit because of the size, but I think also because of the European culture, they tend to be more bureaucratic companies. Like, where there's a lot of approval layers to get something done, and there's in general, less autonomy on the people to take decisions by themselves. Hmm. And also, I would say another kind of difference is timings. Timings are completely different. You know, in Spain, anyone arriving 9:30 a.m. to the office is completely normal. Uh-huh. Leaving 2 hours for lunch is normal. And then you end up going, you end up staying late in the office and not having that work balance. So I kind of rather like more the American timelines, where you are kind of probably earlier in the office, but then, and you try to be very intense the hours you work, but then you have that work life balance where you can still stay with the kids a couple hours or whatever. Before they go to bed. And also, you know, that bureaucracy. I understand the point sometimes, but sometimes it's just too much. And, you know, things that now I can do within the same day would take me 20 days to get 2-3 approvals, because in fact, one of the approvals, he's on holiday for like the whole July. Uh-huh. And then it's like things get stuck and it's difficult to work like that sometimes. So I would say, I think American way of working is more pragmatic, more direct, and more result oriented, more like than process oriented. I would say so.
Yeah. So how do you think that difference has changed your leadership style? Like when you operated in Europe, did you have kind of a different mentality about how you had to approach leading people and being a leader of projects and a leader of folks than you do now?
I wouldn't think that my style have changed in that sense when it comes to lead people or lead teams.
Yeah.
I think, I was very lucky since the beginning of my career, even when I was like, 25, 26, I've been leading teams. Mm-hmm. And teams of people typically older than me. And I've dealt with situations like that almost all my life. Mm-hmm. And I've got to a point where I know how to read kind of my team, what everyone needs and all that. But I'm just because of the feedback I received, let's say in this last year from my team, that I create an atmosphere where everybody feels comfortable of, you know, expressing their opinions, have their point of views and kind of agree and come with like a final plan. And I think I also provide support for everyone to do the thing they need to do or the jobs or their initiatives, and that it goes and runs smoothly. I mean, I help them in that sense to provide the support or to give that other point of view, hey, have you thought about this? But at the end of the day, it's really the great team that I have what really helps me be successful on my role. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say I've changed that much. I would say more or less the same.
Yeah, I was thinking more on this tactics, like if you had different tactics that you might employ to achieve, you know, leadership. Because sometimes leadership can be, I guess, this, you know, I'll pontificate myself slightly here. The leadership, each time you walk into a room, you've got a different group of people. And so while, you know, your intrinsic leadership values may not change, the tactics that you need to achieve getting those people on board with you or getting them to understand and getting them to want to be a part of that team can change. You know, it doesn't always change, but it can. You know, like each group of people might have different things that they value or that they find the most important in that moment. And, you know, so there's, I think for me, like I found that when you talk about some of the best leaders that I found have an innate ability to, you know, it's just like you mentioned, read the room a bit to understand what the needs are of the people that you're standing in front of, and to meet them where they are so that you're not, you know, each room you come into, it's not just, hey, this is the way this stuff happens and this is what I was taught or this is what how I want to see it. Like you adapt a bit as you step into that space.
Yeah, no, I'm completely true. I mean, I think that there's people, for instance, that might need kind of a daily interaction of some kind, even if it's like 5-minute chat, but they just, you know, like to feel being part of the team and have more direct contact with me. And then there's some others that would like just to be more autonomous, but then that, you know, they like to, that you give them the voice when they need to talk about the specific topic and kind of feel that their opinion is appreciated and listened. So yeah, all this kind. But I think what is more important in my role is that I'm very, there was kind of a disconnect between business teams and the application team before I got here. And I think that I've been very helpful to kind of, you know, create those bridges back. And now we are all in the same boat. We work very closely with them. We have very good relationship with them. And I think the fact that they see that good relation with me, it's also helping them to open more and be more close to their teams too. So I think that's been really important in this particular situation.
Yeah. So I'm going way back here. You grew up in Madrid, Spain?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. So I have two questions. One is more general. I was just curious. What was it like growing up in Madrid? For folks here in the United States, Madrid is this, you know, it's this beautiful foreign city that, you know, a number of us get to visit. But it's, you know, it's a very old city, and I guess I'll leave it at that. Let's share a little bit about what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, it's I still think Madrid is a great city to live. I think in general and in Spain, but Madrid in particular, just because of the cultural offer, you know, you have huge cities in terms of tourism surrounding Madrid. You have like the north part of the city with all the mountains and snow. You have different lakes. Like, it's really beautiful. You know, transportation is awesome. Like, you can move everywhere without, you know, by public transport, which is very different here in Houston.
So in Houston, like everybody, it's an hour to get everywhere in Houston, right? Like, that's the joke. Hey, I'm gonna go here. How long did it take? An hour.
No, man, and it's just like, I would say the network of buses and metro is just not near where it should be, probably. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was a really, really good childhood there, and we didn't have all my family because the rest of my family is from Valencia, which you can see here on the picture. But it was a
beautiful
nice
picture for the listeners of the podcast. This is for audio only. There's a beautiful picture of some buildings in Valencia behind you. So I'll just say they're beautiful so that you all can imagine exactly what that means.
Yeah. And then you know, it's curious because there's a lot of life in the city. Like, you go out, you know, 8, 9 p.m., 10 p.m. and streets are crowded. Mm-hmm. Everyone is out. Like, people are more condensed within, like, kind of more like New York, Manhattan, where like everything is kind of there in the city. So there's more people walking around and all that. Whereas in Houston, everything is distributed and all that. And then nightlife, I'm not even going to comment on that. But
that's
a lot of party.
So the second question I had is, and this goes back to leadership, but it's also going back into your past and so you're from Spain here working in the US. So I'm curious if you feel there's some skill or kind of like cultural piece to how you were brought up that you've brought into your work and what that is. Kind of this different, like, you know, this is a special thing, or this is, you know, we care about this thing in Spanish culture, and this is a thing that I bring this every day to what I do.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's the Spanish or maybe more like family values kind of
or family
thing,
culture. Sure.
Yeah. So I think I'm really calm when it comes to dealing with tense or critical situations. And I think that I transmit to my team, and my team feels better about it. I mean, we might have, and especially in IT, I mean, there's always some kind of issue or an incident or whatever. So be able to have that calm and think through it in a calm way, it's really important. And I think that's something that I brought kind of like, I don't know if it's family genetics or Spain thing, but I think that's one of the things. The other is listening all the time. Like listen to the people, really understand the problem, really understand what they want. And maybe I would say also that people reading ability. I think that, well, I've been in Madrid, but I've been in Valencia, and there's like very, very many different ranges of people I met through my life in Spain. So you always kind of have to have that people reading ability to make sure you don't get into trouble. And I think that's also something I brought to here. Nice. You know, make sure you read people.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking here. So in the podcast, we also, one of the things we talk to guests about is we call them humorous childhood discussions. And this involves things like what was your first computer, or what, you know, like video game systems would you have played as a kid and stuff like that. So I want to ask you, and I'm really curious to hear what some of this stuff was like. So when you were young and you were, you know, you're like, hey, well, you mentioned you went to electrical engineering is your primary, mechanical engineering. I'm sorry. So when you were a kid, where were you exposed to technology first? Like, how did you, where was that?
Yeah, I remember exactly. I had a neighborhood that used to have these NASA videos of like projects to the moon and all the technology behind it and all that. And that kind of started me wanting to be at that time an astronomer engineering. Then I changed slightly, but yeah, I mean, since I was like 5-6 years old, I was watching these videos and wanted to. So I'm now close to NASA.
you're in Houston, right?
I'm close.
There was another gentleman who was on the podcast. I interviewed him a couple months ago. He works for a space startup that works with SpaceX. So, you know, maybe I could connect you with him, and then you two can talk. And then, you know, who knows, you know, at some point in the future, maybe you'll be like, hey, you want to come work to fly rockets?
Cool. No, yeah, that was really my first thing with technology.
Yeah. So now your first computer, like computers are somewhat the same across the world. It's not like this is somehow going to be some crazy difference, but I was just curious when you plunked down that first computer in your house or the one you had, what was it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was 485. I think it was called, or 482.
486.
486.
So 486. 486.
My hub, I remember, had these disks like to save information and all that. Like
So were they still, say, now I'm working on dating what era you're coming from here. Were they the floppy disks that you couldn't bend? You could still bend them?
Yeah. Those were my first person. And then, I mean, at the school we had also, we did some practice on the school on some stuff. But yeah, I think that was the first one at home. And I would say we mainly use it to, I think, download movies and songs and all that. I mean, it wasn't that bad, I would say, at that time. Like, it was just starting, and everybody had Napster, all these things.
Yeah, I remember the Napster era. The Napster era was. I have a lot of music from that period of time that I downloaded online, and you know, the funny thing was that eventually it all became so cheap that you could go subscribe to a service, which you still do. I still subscribe to it, and it would take your library and it would match it to Apple's library, and then you could re-download the higher quality versions of the songs. Eventually your efforts on Napster paid off. I mean, it took like 15 years, but if you hung on to those, like those low quality rips of MP3s that you got in 2002, you were later in like 2013 able to download the CD quality versions of them. In the end.
No, that's cool. And also I did a lot of gaming too at that time, but I've never been like huge in gaming. I've been more like a sport guy, kind of out in the park playing soccer kind of guy, but also some gaming too.
Nice. So can you tell us something that somebody might find interesting or wouldn't know about you? So like, and I'll share some details so that you know, so that you have a little something to go on. But let's see. So for me, I think I shared this before. Oh, Let's see. I once DJed a wedding. I was hired to DJ a wedding. So I was a wedding DJ. Not professionally. Cool.
I DJ at home.
You do DJ. You actually DJ. There you go.
Yeah.
I'm sure my DJ was incredibly subpar compared to the DJ that you do if you're doing professionally.
No, believe me, I don't do it that often. So I'm not that professional neither. But yeah, I mean, I have a couple of hobbies, kind of curious. One of them is I would like to write a movie script.
Ah.
I've been thinking on it for years. I have most of my script in my head, but I just never sit down to write it. And this year I thought, like, well, I'm gonna do it. So I have that on my objectives for the year. And another one is I like algorithm trading. Like, mm-hmm. you know, gone through some books to kind of go through Python code and download the stock prices, history, and run some backtesting and algorithms. So I like that too. I spend some time, especially during pandemic that I had more time, I spend a lot of time in that.
Hmm,
unfortunately, nice. Now with my kids, I don't do that often now. But
yeah, the kids do take a lot of additional time. They suck up your free time pretty rapidly.
Yeah. Almost close to zero these days. Mm-hmm. They are 2 and 4, so kind of the time where you have to be really on top of them and playing with them. So
yeah. I got news for you. It gets worse. You think you have no time. You still have no time later once they start like sports and all the other things like that. Mine are currently just about 7 and 10. So, you know, we just finished Little League baseball season, you know, then in the fall, soccer will start and, you know, all the things.
Yeah, that's curious. I was the assistant coach on the T-ball team.
Oh, yeah. Had
literally no idea of baseball.
Yeah.
But they haven't anyone. So I said, like, okay, mm-hmm. I'll do it. I'll help. I mean, this age doesn't really... it's not important that you have that knowledge, right? It's just make sure they hit the ball and run first base. So it was fine.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. T-ball is super, super simple because like all they're really doing is conditioning them to understand that, you know, there's a ball, you swing, yay, we hit, yeah, run to this base. Please don't dig in the outfield. You know, pay attention. There's a ball coming.
it was really funny. Especially the atmosphere in general was really good, so
mm-hmm.
really enjoy.
Yeah, I did assistant coach. My younger one is the next level up from T-ball this year. He's I think it's called modified, so they do like the pitching machine and stuff like that. And yeah, but man, you know, squirrely, like seven, 8 year old boys, ask him, hey, stand and look at this thing and look, what's the ball? And of course, because the risk here is that in baseball, you know, if you stop paying attention and somebody hits a ball, you don't know where it's coming. You know, like you'll get hit. It's almost like there's a lesson to be learned there in getting, you know, not that they should get hit, but like if they don't pay attention, they learn quickly that they need to pay attention, right? If they get beaned once.
No, it's interesting.
So going back, you mentioned your other, your kind of bucket list is writing a movie script. You said you've got that on your list for this year. It's June. Have you started?
No, because included it on the list. But it was literally 1 month ago. I was thinking about it and it's like,
oh, okay.
It's become the time. Like, I'm going to do it. So I hope to start within the next couple of weeks. But yeah, I mean, as I said, I have almost everything in my mind. It's just with this kind of like snatch movies or Lock and Stock, Guy Ritchie movies, kind of several mafia gangs, and, you know, how they interact between them and all that.
You're drawing some level of, you know, personal like experience knowledge. So. We're coming up towards the end of our interview here. And I always make sure to ask our guests, there's really a couple of questions about leadership that I ask at the end, but one of them is, what advice do you have to share with folks? So let's say somebody's new coming up in the ranks. And there's, you know, so I listen to our podcast being like, I want some tips from people who've been in this business for a while. And, you know, we have a pretty wide range of folks. I mean, there's folks who are IT directors in the like infrastructure sense. You're much more in the, you know, your applications and business, you know, business intelligence development work. You know, so yours is a little, I would call it project-based almost, software project-based in a lot of ways. What advice would you have for somebody in leadership advice for them?
Okay. I would say two of them. One is, you know, take care of your team, you know, be on top of your team needs and make sure they are comfortable and happy working on the projects they are, because that really is what gets things done. And then second, I think strategically in a way that things can scale and work in the future. Don't try to put a band-aid today, because as you grow as an organization or the business team need more speed or better products, that band-aid is not going to work. So think strategically as to how to get to a product that is scalable or a roadmap that is scalable over the time. I think this, with these two companies that I've worked in the past with that high growth, it's really, really important. Like, it makes a difference.
Mm, nice. Thank you. The other is, I would say, I call this the maybe the lesson, the leader, the personal lessons question. You went back, you mentioned you've been a manager since you were younger. You know, you were a young manager, 26, you said. And if you were to go back today, you look back at 26-year-old you, what would you give yourself advice about? Or what did you maybe do? Like, you look back and you're like I could share a small anecdote to kind of like, I also was a manager at 26 as well. I was managing some consulting teams, and you know, I could think about some of the times I didn't always understand how to exercise leadership, and how to handle the authority or the mantle of leadership in the same way. So like, if you go back in a 26-year-old me and somebody was like, I don't want to do this, you tell me what it is, you know, why should I do this? And I'll be like, well, it's because I told you to, and I'm the boss, you know, like, oh yeah, 'cause I'm the boss. Right. But that's not really the most effective way to execute as a leader. And I recognize that now, 20 years later, you know, I mean, so over time I've learned that lesson. So I'm just curious, like, what would you give the 26-year-old self, Carlos, and say, man, don't do that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I would say, I would have, had a better college life if I would have better organization at that time. I wasn't that organized, and that led me to have to spend summers studying, whereas some other of my colleagues were doing internships in like a bank or in a oil and gas company, and after 5 years of doing these internships, they were in a better position than I was when going out to the market after college. And I think kind of being focused, and it's difficult, right? Because it's the time you are 18, you want to go out, you know some girls, whatever. And it's just like, it's the perfect time for also you to be focused on your career and start developing that career from that moment on, and do those kind of internships, etc. So I think that's one of the things that I always have thought I would have done better. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. No, I mean, our life, in a lot of ways, our life is, you know, the path that we followed is what leads us to today. So, like, you know, you can't stand on the back. It's not worth it, if you will, most of the time, to go back and change it or to wish that. But, you know, there's certainly like there's always that thing, like if somebody was, you know, I tell somebody who was a young manager, I'd be like, you can't execute like this, you know. So like, I always find it's useful to reminisce a little bit sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, so, I think in terms of management, I did also have some experiences back then where, you know, people kind of were, I wouldn't say really saying it, but kind of trying to pretend, oh yeah, I'm older, so I know what I'm doing. But I was always really good of selling them why is it that we were gonna do it that way and kind of getting them on the boat. So I was lucky to have that ability of bringing them in and gaining their respect. So
yeah, we'd be going back, I would touch that back to that sounds like your skills of being able to read people that, you know, you were talking about from growing up, like having to read people on the street, if you will, to know like what do I got to do in this situation.
Yeah, all right,
Carlos, thank you so much for investing your time with us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Douglas. It's been a pleasure.
That's a wrap on today's episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm Doug Kavine, and we look forward to coming to you on our next episode.